convalescent typhoids, and one of the ways in which I eked out my still slender diet was by robbing the sugar bowl at meals. That day, I think it was, the deck furniture was put out on the Ella, numbers of white wicker chairs and tables, with bright cushions to match the awnings. I had a pair of ancient opera glasses, as obsolete as my amputating knives, and like them, a part of my heritage. By that time, I felt a proprietary interest in the Ella, and, through my glasses, carefully focused with a pair of scissors, watched the arrangement of the deck furnishings. A girl was directing the men. I judged, from the poise with which she carried herself, that she was attractive and knew it. How beautiful she was, and how well she knew it, I was to find out before long. McWhirter, to the contrary, she had nothing to do with my decision to sign as a sailor on the Ella. One of the bright spots of that long, hot summer was McWhirter. We had graduated together in June, and, in October, he was to enter a hospital in Buffalo as a resident. But he was as indigent as I, and from June to October is 4 months. 4 months, he said to me. Even at 2 meals a day, boy, that's something over 240, and I can eat 4 times a day without a struggle. Wouldn't you think one of these overworked for the good of humanity dubs would take a vacation and give me a chance to hold down his practice? Nothing of the sort developing, McWhirter went into a drug store and managed to pull through the summer with unimpaired cheerfulness, confiding to me that he secured his luncheons free at the soda counter. He came frequently to see me, bringing always a pocketful of chewing gum, which he assured me was excellent to allay the gnawings of hunger, and later, as my condition warranted it, small bags of gumdrops and other pharmacy confections. McWhirter it was who got me my berth on the Ella. It must have been about the 20th of July, for the Ella sailed on the 28th. I was strong enough to leave the hospital, but not yet physically able for any prolonged exertion. McWhirter, who was short and stout, had been alternately flirting with the nurse as she moved in and out preparing my room for the night, and sizing me up through narrowed eyes. "No," he said, evidently following a private line of thought, "you don't belong behind a counter, Leslie. I'm darned if I think you belong in the medical profession, either. The British Army'd suit you." "The what?" "You know, Kipling idea. Riding horseback, head of a column, undress uniform, colonel's wife making eyes at you, leading last hopes and all that." The British Army with Kipling trimmings being out of the question, the original issue is still before us. I'll have to work, Mac, and work like the devil, if I'm to feed myself. There being no answer to this, McWhirter contented himself with eyeing me. "I'm thinking," I said, "of going to Europe. The sea is calling me, Mac." "So was the grave a month ago, but it didn't get you. Don't be an ass, boy. How are you going to sea?"
"Before the mast."
This, apparently conveying no meaning to McWhirter, I supplemented, "as a common sailor." He was indignant at first, offering me his room and a part of his small salary, until I got my strength. Then he became dubious. And finally, so well did I paint my picture of long idle days on the ocean, of sweet cool nights under the stars, with breezes that purred through the sails, rocking the ship to slumber, finally he waxed enthusiastic, and was even for giving up the pharmacy at once and sailing with me. He had been fitting out the storeroom of a sailing yacht with drugs, he informed me, and doing it under the personal direction of the owner's wife. "I've made a hit with her," he confided. "Since she's learned I'm a graduate M.D., she's letting me do the whole thing. I've made up some lotions to prevent sunburn, and that seasick prescription of old Larimer's, and she thinks I'm the whole cheese. I'll suggest you as ship's doctor." "How many men in the crew?" "8, I think, or 10. It's a small boat, and carries a small crew." "Then they don't want a ship's doctor." "If I go, I'll go as a sailor," I said firmly. "And I want your word, Mac, not a word about me, except that I am honest." You'll have to wash decks, probably.
I am filled with a wild longing to wash decks, I asserted, smiling at his disturbed face.
I should probably also have to polish brass. There's a great deal of brass on the boat.
How do you know that?
When I told him, he was much excited, and, although it was dark, and the Ella consisted of three lights, he insisted on the opera glasses and was persuaded he saw her. Finally, he put down the glasses and came over to me.
Perhaps you are right, Leslie, he said soberly. You don't want charity any more than they want a ship's doctor. Wherever you go and whatever you do, whether you're swabbing decks in your bare feet or polishing brass railings with an old sock, you're a man.
He was more moved than I had ever seen him, and ate a gumdrop to cover his embarrassment. Soon after that he took his departure, and the following day he telephoned to say that, if the sea was still calling me, he could get a note to the captain recommending me. I asked him to get the note.
Good old Mac. The sea was calling me, true enough, but only dire necessity was driving me to ship before the mast. Necessity, and perhaps what, for want of a better name, we call destiny. For what is fate but inevitable law, inevitable consequence? The stirring of my blood, generations removed from a seafaring ancestor, my illness, not a cause but a result. McWhirter filling prescriptions behind the glass screen of a pharmacy, and fitting out in porcelain jars the medicine closet of the Ella. Turner and his wife, Schwartz, the mulatto Tom, Singleton, and Elsa Lee, all thrown together, a hodgepodge of characters, motives, passions, and hereditary tendencies, through an inevitable law working together toward that terrible night of August 12, when hell